when you guys were packing to move, what percentage of the boxes were just your hats?
Oh, probably like 3%. Because we had like 100 boxes. It was insane.
So you had three full boxes of hats.
They were what's known as the Home Depot small box. They were not extra small, which is also a size.
Hey there. Welcome to Hot Takedown, the show where the hot takes of the sports world meet the numbers that prove them right or tear them down. Today is June 15th, 2021. And I'm Sarah Ziegler, the sports editor at 538. Joining us from Pennsylvania is senior sports writer Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Sarah. It's great to be here in Pennsylvania. My wife and I have moved away from New York City. And we're just enjoying the pastoral nature of the less urban conglomeration.
That's how you describe cities, an urban conglomeration?
Certainly that's how I would describe New York City.
Sure, that makes sense. And from California is 538 contributor Jeff Foster. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Sarah.
We have a ton of sports to talk about this weekend, along with Neil's move. I did want to talk about one scary moment from the weekend, from the Euros action. Denmark's Christian Eriksen collapsed from a cardiac arrest and needed to be resuscitated with CPR and a defibrillator. He was awake when he was taken off the pitch, thank goodness, and is stable in a hospital now. But that was one of the scariest things I've ever seen happen in sports.
Sarah, what did you think? I'm curious where you stood on the, you know, immediately people kind of took to Twitter as they do in every situation, this no different, and was really getting on the broadcast, both, you know, the ESPN broadcast and the overseas, the BBC, I guess, or whomever was showing it overseas, for keeping the cameras on the field and ultimately sort of forcing the Danish players to surround Eriksen. Do you think they handled that correctly? I mean, I think it's really hard, you know, to judge a TV, you know, a broadcast in the moment when something like that's happening. I mean, obviously hindsight's 20/20, but I was curious if you were part of the chorus that was bemoaning that.
I mean, it's really tough because, you know, sports always crosses this boundary into like, is this entertainment? Is this real life? What are we even doing? We saw that a ton over the past year with COVID, you know, being a part of our sports, of our entertainment, kind of intruding on it. But I guess I don't feel like cutting away from things. I always want to know more information. I had the same take
in that I think people were frustrated and upset, and it was a terrible moment. And, you know, in many ways that broadcast decision sort of became the punching bag because of a lack of other options. And I do agree that it is live sports and it's live news and it's happening in front of you, and it's hard to watch. But at the same time, I do think there's a certain responsibility to tell you what's happening. And the other thing people were sort of criticizing, which was interesting, I guess it's just people will criticize anything no matter what happens, but was the decision to continue the game.
That's exactly what I was about to say, was I saw more criticism of them finishing the game later than anything about the broadcast itself. And you even saw people from Denmark's team criticizing UEFA's decision to do that.
Yeah, it was, you know, there were these reports that, well, the players decided to, but then does it make sense to be asking the players to make that kind of decision that quickly?
Yeah, then Eriksen himself sort of was the one telling them to go on.
Which is kind of like, that's such a cop out, like blame the guy in the hospital for like, like, come on. Yeah, it seemed like they could have just called it a draw and let it go. I know they have this very tight timeline they have to stick to, but why finish the game at all? Like, was that not an option? Seems like that could have been an option.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if it's impossible to say whether it's related, but you saw Kasper Schmeichel, their goalies, like a world-class goalie, make a pretty bad mistake. And you also saw, you know, someone miss a penalty. So, who knows whether it's related, but they weren't. They it would be very understandable if those players had other things on their mind at that moment.
Yeah, I didn't feel like watching soccer after that, much less playing soccer. So I feel like that was probably mishandled.
Well, UEFA was involved, so I mean, yeah, we can expect mishandling.
Exactly. On today's show, we'll check in with the NHL playoffs as we get ever closer to the Stanley Cup final. Then we'll talk about the U.S. Open and whether the ongoing beef between Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau is good for golf. And finally, we'll take a deep dive into data with our rabbit hole of the week. The Stanley Cup semifinals have begun, because that's a thing in this weird season. The New York Islanders took Game 1 from the Tampa Bay Lightning, and the Vegas Golden Knights beat the Montreal Canadiens last night. So we wanted to talk about these two matchups and how likely an upset looks in either one of them. On the Athletics Hockey Podcast, Arthur Staple discussed why the Islanders were able to catch the Lightning so flat-footed in Game 1.
So I think the Islanders knew what they needed to do against Tampa, and maybe some of the unfamiliarity. I think some of the Lightning players did talk about it. They played two playoff series against teams in Florida and Carolina that play a very different style than the Islanders. I don't think that there's a team that plays the way the Islanders do and does it as effectively as the Islanders do that Tampa saw all season. And I'm sure you have to get used to it. So I think for the Islanders, they were well prepared with their regular season in the tough East Division, two tough playoff series. And I think coming off a really good Game 6 against the Bruins, where they did play that way and were really opportunistic, they were ready for this one. And it just looked like the Lightning weren't. And you can't be unprepared against the Islanders. You have to have your details ready and be able to attack, or else they're just going to take whatever they throw at you and throw it right back in your face. And they certainly did that a lot in the second and third periods.
So is it the Islanders' unfamiliar style that's giving them an early edge against Tampa? Or, Neil, are there other ways that New York is overperforming its ELO odds?
Well, I do like the idea that, you know, we're finally getting to see teams against opponents that they haven't played the whole season. Like, this is one of the most unique seasons in hockey history, just because the teams have been self-contained within these divisions for months and months and months. And then now finally they're seeing opponents that they don't know, like, the backs of their hands. So there may be something to that. I also think that just the Islanders continue to get outstanding goaltending. Semyon Varlamov had 30 saves on 31 shots in that first game, and he's been really dominant throughout the second round and then now into the third round of the playoffs too. And I think Tampa was getting kind of frustrated by that at times, because they are, you know, they have all of these talented offensive players and stars. And the Islanders are just more of an ensemble type of team that has a lot of depth of contributors. They have great goaltending. And so, yeah, I mean, they're a dangerous team. And maybe we've been guilty of sleeping on them. A lot of people have been guilty of sleeping on them. But right now, they're probably the second most likely team to win the Cup, considering the state of each series. At least that's the way that the ELO odds have it right now. And I think that's rightly so. They've been really impressive in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, we've been saying this, well, you know, for most of the regular season and into these playoffs, that the playoffs don't really begin until we see teams that are not playing teams they've been playing over and over all season. And, you know, that certainly was true with Tampa playing Florida and Carolina, two teams they were very familiar with, and then had the added bonus of, you know, having Nikita Kucherov and Steven Stamkos and some of these guys who weren't maybe there all season, and having that in addition to a team they were very familiar with, which sort of made it seem an already sort of team with very few weaknesses getting even stronger against familiar opponents, led to a sort of predictable result. And now I think we're in a little bit more classic NHL unpredictable zone, where we should make no predictions, because who knows what's going to happen. And, you know, the Islanders are one of these teams that I think you could, like, throw every hockey cliche at them. They have a system. They all buy into the system. They all, know their role and sort of make up for a lack of star power by just playing smart under Barry Trotz and not making many mistakes. And, you know, the Lightning, obviously, the best asset probably might be the power play. And then you saw an Islanders team that wasn't going into the box very often, not giving them many chances to get on that power play, which is so devastating. And, they're deep. They have a lot of different guys who can score, and they're not a team that's built around one or two stars or one line, which is pretty common these days in the playoffs. And in fact, a lot of those teams that are built around one star and or, you know, one great line are already golfing. So it will be a trend as we look at these four teams that I think you'll see four teams that are not, you know, dependent, overly dependent on a couple playmakers or a couple goal scorers.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jeff. I mean, Vegas and Tampa have stars, but they have a number of them, so they're not like solely dependent on like one guy, and they do have a lot of depth. And then the Islanders are just a lot of depth. And Montreal, we can go into how they've gotten here, but they also sort of have gotten a lot of contributions from a lot of different places. So it is such a testament, and maybe that's like the rule of hockey now, is that you have to have a lot of guys that you can throw a bunch of lines at your opponent, or just the way things have played out this year. But yeah, it seems like the more star-driven teams are gone, and they've been gone in a lot of cases for a long time. Looking at you, Edmonton, Toronto, Pittsburgh, Washington, you know, all the teams that lost in the first round, basically.
All right. Well, let's turn to the other series and talk about the most underdoggy underdog in this Final Four. Like, I know the Maple Leafs are cursed and all. The Winnipeg Jets aren't, to my knowledge. And yet here Montreal is in, they lost last night, but they're still, you know, they got a chance. They're plucky. Are they good? Are they any good at all? They have looked better than we've thought they would, right?
Yes. I think it's another case of I kind of always beat this drum during the playoffs, but they've gotten excellent goaltending from Carey Price, who now looks like he's basically the Carey Price of 5, 6, 7 years ago when he was winning the MVP. So that helps. Even last night, he had a great robbery of, I think it was Mark Stone, had an empty net shot, and he sort of reached out and plucked it with the glove. Now, they did still lose, and by not an inconsiderable margin. But at the same time, I think that that's sort of the formula. That's a proven playoff formula, is have a bunch of guys that, you know, different heroes on different nights that can kind of come through for you, and then have a really great goaltender. And maybe the reason why Montreal caught us by surprise is that Carey Price wasn't that great during the regular season. He arguably wasn't even the best goaltender on his own team during the regular season, because Jake Allen had better numbers, at least statistically, in terms of save percentage during the regular season. So we didn't know what to expect of Carey Price. And we've seen these cases where it's like, well, this goaltender has a history of playing well in the playoffs, so maybe they'll flip on the switch. And I would say, sometimes that does happen, and sometimes that doesn't happen, and there's not a whole lot to kind of predict whether it will or won't, but if you know that it will, your team is going to have a really good chance to make a good deep playoff run, and that's what's happening in Montreal.
Yeah, they're like so many plucky underdogs in NHL history, they're boring, and that's a combination that goes hand in hand a lot. I mean, that's the old Devils model. I mean, we're going to win, maybe unexpectedly win, and we're going to do it by boring you to death. maybe I'm overselling like how boring they are, but they definitely, like, you know, clog up the zone and try to win these 3-2 games, 2-1 games, and lean heavily on their goaltending, which is a good model. I mean, that's what you got to do when you're not, you know, top to bottom filled with award-winning star talent. They have a couple good young players, Cole Caulfield, Nick Suzuki. Those guys are pretty, I think, have pretty good futures with the team. But they definitely, you know, I do think also they have benefited in the system they play, which again, you know, you'll see the trend here, is they go with the depth and they lean on that. They have run against two teams. First, the Toronto team that lost John Tavares in the early moments of that series, which really did... I mean, they were already kind of a one-line team with the Marner and Matthews line, made them a real kind of one-dimensional team with that line. And then you had the Jets team that lost Scheifele on that dirty hit, and they were a kind of a one-line team with the the Wheeler line, and then they lost one of the key components of that guy. So they did kind of get some benefit from facing teams that were missing key players in key moments, and now they're facing the Vegas team that is just a completely different team altogether. I'm kind of with the consensus here, even though I picked Montreal early on and then took back that prediction and then bragged about that prediction the following week later. I'm kind of off their bandwagon at the moment, just because I think Vegas is too good. And, you know, that series started at the Vegas. I haven't seen this in a while. In a semifinal was minus 500. That's one of the biggest. I think that might have made them the biggest favorite in any series we've seen so far. And then this is the third round, which.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. That's definitely true.
Yeah, makes me think maybe this playoff system is not perfect.
Well, it's the reseeding, right? I mean, that was the other thing is that whatever team was the lowest seed coming out of into the Final Four, I guess, out of the second round, out of the divisional, you know, rounds, would be paired with the top seed. And you ended up with Vegas, who has been one of, if not the best team in the league from wire to wire, paired with this Montreal team that like barely made the playoffs and wouldn't have in other divisions. And I think that's what was tailor-made to create a mismatch at this stage, whereas like normally they don't reseed. And so you can end up with these like weird kind of winding paths that match up teams that, you know, it's not guaranteed to create a mismatch the same way that seeding the best versus the fourth best of the Final Four will create.
Yeah. I mean, the problem was the Colorado Vegas series was too good of a series to have in the second round. I mean, that feels like a classic conference finals matchup, and that's probably the conference final matchup that would make the most sense, but you know, we got that early. But I mean, it you know, maybe it doesn't matter. Colorado or Vegas wins, they had to go through the other team anyway, might as well just do it get it over with.
So are you guys rooting for the two best teams to make the final and like give us the, you know, the, to be able to really crown the best team? Or are you rooting for the underdogs here to make it, to maybe lift the cup?
I'm mixing and matching because I really like, I like this Vegas team a lot. And I think that they're sort of like due to win a cup, you know, after that.
They've
only been around 3 years. But no, I mean, just the way that they came in and came so close that first year, and that was such an incredible story. And they've been knocking on the door really ever since that, you know, it would be awesome to see them, you know, finish that job off. No offense to the Canadiens, who are also, it would be a great underdog story. I just don't think it's going to happen. And then, yeah, but I am rooting for the Islanders in the other series. Some of that is because of Tampa Bay and the cap shenanigans or whatever you want to call it. It was perfectly legal, but perhaps against the spirit of competitive balance in the NHL and possibly something that they need to address in future CBAs and rules around finances. But anyway, that's another thing. But yeah, I like the Islanders. I just think that they're, you know, a really a plucky team. I like plucky teams.
I generally root against Florida sports full stop
in every sport or just hockey because it doesn't make sense for
I definitely root against Florida hockey sport. Just because that makes the least sense, but I root against all Florida teams, and this goes to the college level. Maybe it's not fair.
You're just mad about Citrus Bowls where Florida played Michigan.
That's
back
probably
in the 90s
true, yeah.
Screw you, Rex Grossman.
Michigan actually had a good history against Florida. They beat Tebow, you know, and Lloyd Carr's final game. Look it up.
Yeah, I'll get right on that.
Yeah.
Was it the Gator Bowl? What bowl was that?
Literally nobody cares.
No one knows. That information's probably not even on the internet.
Probably not.
But Tampa in particular, I mean, okay, enough. We get it. Tampa, you're good for the next 40 years, I think, between the Bucks and the Lightning. I mean, in the Lightning, this Lightning team, I mean, we forget. Well, I guess we don't forget because we seem to talk about it a lot. But they were the most dominant regular season team ever and then lost in the first round, then won the cup and now have a chance to win another cup. I mean,
and they also won the cup in 2004. So like this would be their third cup.
Yeah, that's too many.
I mean, that's all well and good. I get that. I actually like what they did with the cap. And this goes maybe back to my love of
your love of cheating.
Look, the rules are there and they worked within it. We did a story early in the season about like the amazing capology that the Lightning used, not just with Kucherov, but with really everything they were doing to like just slide under the cap and the shenanigans they were going to have to do with it all the way along the season. And I like that. I mean, look, you set up a dumb cap and you set up rules like this and very specific kinds of rules. People are going to like work around them. We see this in the NFL all the time where it's like, wait, is the salary cap a thing? Apparently not, because teams are just signing whatever. You know, this is, they have whole people hired to work around these rules, work within them, but to be creative about it. And I like the creativity, so I'm on board with the Lightning.
Yeah, I have no problems with that. And they look, they're well, there's no denying it, they're a well-run team. Say what you will, you know, whether they're bending rules or not, which I don't think they are. They are taking advantage of existing rules. So blame the people who created those rules if you have a problem with that.
And who will definitely
I will.
And who will definitely be changing them this offseason.
That's good. I'm rooting for the Islanders. It's interesting as a Devils fan, which I say all the time. Devils hate the Rangers. Islanders hate the Rangers. Devils and the Islanders, it's kind of a enemy of my enemy is my friend. I don't know if we're friends.
There's also
but
a number of Islanders on, or a number of Devils yeah, on this Islanders
team. Yeah, Palmieri and Zajac. So, you know, we do business together.
wow. But we're all, is anyone here rooting for the Habs? Are we just all like, yeah, Golden Knights? Yay.
Oh, I don't know.
It would be a great story. I'm not rooting against it. I just think that Vegas is perhaps inevitable.
You know, it's like I'd want to root for the Canadian team, regardless of who it is. But I guess in this case, maybe, you know, I know Montreal's the one team that definitely the entire country is not rallying behind. They're the most polarizing team for sure in Canada. You know, maybe it's surely because they play in Quebec and there's a lot of history there. Or maybe they're, you know, just you're either a Montreal fan or you're a Toronto fan, and you know, everyone kind of drew their battle lines early among the original six teams, but they're definitely not popular through and through. So it's not like it would be a big moment for the country if they were to win, although it would be good to stop talking about that streak. Talk about something else. Talk about some other streak.
It would bookend the streak also, because they were the last team, Canadian team, to win the cup, and then they'd be the most recent one.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if the Canadians can pull it out, and we'll have our final set before too long. It's, you know, just one game in the book so far in the semifinals, but yeah, we'll see how these series go. All right, we can leave this discussion here for now. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back to talk about golf. Golf's U.S. Open begins this Thursday at San Diego's Torrey Pines, and we're coming into it with a fair amount of drama. This will be Jon Rahm's first tournament after self-isolating with COVID-19. Phil Mickelson will be trying to recapture the magic he used to win the PGA Championship. And we have two golfers who are not liking each other at all, very publicly. Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau have never exactly been the best of friends, but their rivalry recently went from cold to beer cooler full of ice cold, with DeChambeau getting some fans ejected for yelling "Go Brooksy" at him, and then Koepka offering cases of beer to those heckling fans. While speaking to reporters after the Palmetto Championship, Koepka said that the public sniping wasn't a bad thing.
It's good for the game. I really do. I mean, the fact that golf's on pretty much every news outlet for, I don't know, about 2 weeks, pretty consistently, I think that's a good thing. It's growing the game.
So I think we're on record on this show that feuding, like cheating, is good. But what I want to ask, Jeff, is if a feud between these two particular golfers is a good entry point into the sport for new fans. Is this like
public
eye rolling, Twitter beefing, that's good to get people to care about the game?
This is great. Look, I've had people who don't even like golf, don't follow golf, ask me about this or show interest in this feud. Namely, the clip of Brooks rolling his eyes and getting distracted by DeChambeau walking behind him at the PGA Championship being the sort of the peak moment of this feud. But yes, it's great. Why wouldn't it be great? First of all, as I say over and over, it could be my slogan, my catchphrase at this point. villains are good for sports. The interesting thing about these guys is that they're kind of both villains.
Yeah, I was going to say, what happens when they're both villains?
They kind of both play the heel role. I mean, you know, they do have kind of different personas, you know, like Brooks is kind of the bro and Bryson's kind of the nerd. And normally you'd be expecting Brooks to be like stuffing Bryson in a locker, but Bryson's huge.
Yeah, I was going to say they subvert those tropes. Yeah,
so, I mean, they're both big, so they don't really fit into that thing. But they do kind of have those kind of personalities, at least, where one is just getting visibly annoyed by the other's nonstop talking. But they're fun for the game. Can you imagine a final round of the U.S. Open and these two guys are one, which could very easily happen.
Oh, man.
And these two are paired together? I mean, who's not going to watch that? I mean, I generally think golf is doing great regardless. I think there's so many interesting players and exciting young players. And the narrative, you know, that was so driven around one player for so long, which was good for the sport too. But the problem with that was that when Tiger wasn't involved, we saw the viewership sort of fall off a cliff, and that can still happen. But now we have like a different narrative each week, it seems. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a number of storylines that are easily possible that would be must-see TV, like Rory possibly winning or Spieth possibly winning or Bryson and Brooks going at it. There are a lot of, or Tony Finau. Imagine if Tony Finau is about to win his first major and only his second tournament after all these close calls. So there's a lot of things that could happen, you know, looking at this tournament. But this is obviously one that I think probably is the most mass appeal of the Brooksy here and Bryson ongoing feud, which I do think, you know, they're both kind of leaning into a little bit, or at least Brooks is a little bit getting some joy out of the added attention that's coming from it.
There are some conspiracy theorists in the golf world who think this is all manufactured, that none of this is real, that they're actually they don't hate each other at all. They're just doing this for the pub.
I do think they're both publicity conscious players. You know, Brooks in the past has a history of sort of, you know, clearly getting chafed when he's not getting enough attention. And I think Bryson,
or the wrong attention. Like, yeah, when he didn't want the guy recording him at that right. one point.
And Bryson is someone who clearly likes attention. Sort of everything he does is a cry for attention. You know, that's selling in everything he's accomplished and sort of his transformation as a golfer, you know, a little short, but it is somewhat true. So I do think they are playing it up. But I disagree with the conspiracy theory, because if you watch that video from the PGA, that's legitimate. Unless he's like...
You can't fake that. Yeah.
A masterclass actor. That was a real reaction.
Yeah.
So that makes me think there is a lot of truth behind some of it.
Also, on a random, like, post-match interview, you wouldn't stage something then, I think, anyway. Well, yeah. let's talk about the golf itself. Neil, how evenly matched is this rivalry? How do Brooks and Bryson stack up against each other on the course?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty evenly matched right now. It wasn't always. Brooks started his career out with, you know, all those majors. He still has had the better career than Bryson. He has four majors. Bryson only has one. He's had more. Oddly, they have the same number of total wins, which is another fun note about Brooksy, that he only seems to win the majors. But in terms of overall, like, he has more top 10, top 25, you know, more money in his career. Brooks was once the number one ranked golfer in the world. Bryson can't say that. But more recently, Bryson has been better, and he's number five in the world. Koepka is only number 10, and he's beaten him in our favorite, the all-important strokes gained tee to green stat in each of the past 2 years. Like, he's leading him right now and was ahead last year. So I think it's fair to say that they've sort of caught up, and now it's, I think the other component of the rivalry is you have to have guys that don't like each other. And unless this is some kind of gigantic wrestling style, you know, fake show, which if so, I don't care.
Kudos
to them for doing that. But if, you know, one of the components is they either have to have real or perceived animosity, but they also have to both be really playing at a high level. And I think now you're seeing them both sort of on this collision course in terms of how they're playing, in addition to hating each other. And I think that those are the two ingredients of a great rivalry.
Yeah. The one note on that is that I think Bryson, well, it's not a slump. He has not been playing great in the last, you know, recent form obviously is a hugely important thing when you're evaluating or predicting golf. But since, you know, he won the Arnold Palmer and then he almost won the Players, he's only had one top 10 really since middle March, and not really much. I mean, he hasn't been missing cuts or anything, but he's not been really relevant on Sunday. He did not have a good Masters. I think that's, you know, not a great tournament for him, which I realize now. I think I predicted him before the Masters. Terrible prediction. he did not have a great PGA Championship. So he's not in top form, which would probably, going into this tournament, I would probably give Brooks a little bit of an edge just based on what he was able to do at the PGA Championship, and also what he's able to do at every major. I mean, say what you will about his effort level at the sort of rank and file PGA events, there's no denying the fact that whatever happens with the majors, we see the best version of him, and he cannot be counted out in any of these tournaments, particularly US Open that he's won twice.
It is funny, yeah, like in the three tournaments around the PGA, so the two before, including the Masters, granted, and then the one after, he missed the cut, but then he finished tied for second at the PGA. So it is sort of like, you know, you are getting the best out of him on a stage like that. So yeah, that could be indicative of this week as well.
Yeah. So for people who are perhaps coming into golf through hearing about how these two guys hate each other, and also perhaps hearing about it on a certain podcast, what is the next most interesting story at the US Open? What are you guys going to be paying attention to this weekend that isn't Brooks and Bryson?
Well, I think Jon Rahm is going to be one of the biggest figures because of how everything played out with that withdrawal and the win that he kind of threw away a few weeks ago. But also, like, he's playing really well. And if you look at predictive models, like, they have one at a site called Data Golf, which is, I think, one you and I have enjoyed over the years, Jeff, that uses strokes gained to make predictions. And they have Jon Rahm as the most likely winner. And I think also the betting markets do as well this week. So I think it would be really an interesting redemption arc, I guess, to see him sort of come back from that. I mean, and maybe also the good news is now that he's tested positive, presumably he has gotten over it, has antibodies, and he can't test positive no matter what during this tournament. So he can't be disqualified.
So that's exciting.
Yeah. So he's got that going for him.
Which is nice.
We don't know. I guess we don't know how much it affected him. Obviously, we've seen guys bounce back pretty quick. And, you know, he's a young guy and it tends to obviously not affect people of his age and fitness as much. But who knows? I mean, that is a little bit of an unknown quality. He is getting over a serious disease, so it could be a factor, but I certainly think this course, you know, I think just seeing it was at Torrey, I think Rahm, at least in my mind, is the best fit for this course. Just everything he does kind of plays well in this US Open setting, and also the Torrey Pines setting, where you really have to be long and straight off the tee, and you have to be able to putt and do everything. I mean, really, everything you have to do in golf, but I do think this one in particular favors the Bombers. I think that's part of the reason Brooks and Bryson are getting a lot of attention. We saw what Bryson was able to do a year ago, and it's a pretty good formula for the US Open because the rough is so punishing, but he's able to just power through the rough with his brute force. So he can just drive it a mile down there and he'll be okay because, you know, distance is important. It's a long course, but whereas other people sort of have to be both long and straight. And that's why I think someone like Jordan Spieth is not getting much attention this week because his game just does not line up for this type of course. That being said, Jordan Spieth has been surprising everyone consistently. So I refuse to be surprised if he's up there in the running. And after Phil winning, I really think anything can happen. So that would not shock me at all. I mean, I think the other storyline to throw out there, which is the kind of forgotten storyline I mentioned earlier, would be Rory. I think it just doesn't seem like, for as good as Rory McIlroy is and what he's accomplished, it just, you know, he won a couple weeks ago and still didn't get much attention, or at least comparatively. So I think if he were to be, you know, this is a course that fits Rory. It should fit Rory well with his length, and he's had success there in the past. So we'll see.
I'm always rooting for Rory because I love watching him play, and I want him to be back up there among the leaderboard. I'm also really, like you mentioned this at the beginning too, Tony Finau is a guy who, like, how can you not root for him? And he's come so close so many times that he should do well at Torrey Pines, and it would be fun to see him finally win one.
And he finished second at the Farmers Insurance, which was played at Torrey Pines earlier in the year. So, you know, there's a history there. There's also a history there with Rahm because he's won it before and finished second last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because I do think that course in February compared to that course right now in June, I think it will play a lot different. So, you know, part of me is, I don't want to read too much into what happens in the Farmers, whereas I think with the rough significantly grown out and the course just playing a little bit different because of the weather, it could be quite different. But obviously it can't hurt to be successful at the same golf course.
Well, I think back to Tiger. I mean, this was like, you know, it's kind of a shame he's not healthy at this point. I mean, it's always a shame when he's not healthy, but I mean, he owned this course for so many years, and it's like anytime there was a tournament, major or not, played here, it was like, okay, Tiger's gonna have a fighting chance. Yeah.
I think he literally owns it. I'm pretty sure the city of San Diego was just like, you take it, it's yours now. All right, well, the U.S. Open tees off on Thursday. We can leave this discussion here for now. We'll be back in a moment for our rabbit hole of the week. At 5:38, we often find ourselves falling down various rabbit holes of data. Some lead to stories, some don't. We end each week's show with one of those descents, the hot takedown rabbit hole of the week. Neil, what do you have for us?
Well, did you guys know that a full season of Major League Baseball finished play like last week?
What?
Well, yeah, I know. It's shocking, isn't it? Well, that would have been the case if it were 2020, because teams played their 60th games last week. I believe only the Mets were the team that were not at 60, but they were like within striking distance of that. They may have surpassed it. But that means that essentially this baseball that we have seen this year was all the baseball there was last year. And yet Wild. We still have months to go in this current season. It really kind of is a testament to just how weird and aberrant last season was. We talked about in a previous rabbit hole about all the short season leaders that we would have gotten this season, like Nick Castellanos would have hit 357 if it ended this season. Vlad Guerrero Jr. would have had a 451 on base percentage this season. Lord only knows what Jacob deGrom's ERA would have been over a full season. You'd have to bring out a electron scanning microscope to be able to see it. But this time, we still have way more time to go, but I wanted to sort of look at, like, what would the playoffs have looked like? Because, again, that was the other difference last season, was not only did they play the small number of games, but they also had the playoff system that was kind of an NBA style, like, you know, in each league, you could call those conferences and you seeded it 1 through 8, and then 1 played 8 and 2 played 7 and so forth. And you had a bracket off of that. Personally, I don't know how you guys felt about that. I said at the time I kind of liked it. And I think if we did the same exercise this season, obviously, I'm glad that we have more games. I'm glad we're kind of coming out of the pandemic and we can have more normalcy in baseball and sports and America in general. But at the same time, the playoff matchups we would have gotten could be pretty fun if we had frozen things at the 60-game mark this season. So in the National League, and this is just through 60 games, so any games played since then don't count, but I am using the tiebreakers from last season, which arguably are a little weird to use this season because last year they only played within the division or the opposite division in the other league, whereas this time they played a more sort of balanced schedule across things, but it's a minor detail. So the number one seed in the NL would have been the San Francisco Giants. Bet None of you saw that coming. And they would have played the Cincinnati Reds, the 8 seed, which, you know, the Reds made the playoffs last season as the 7 seed in the National League. So not that different from where they would have been. The number 2 seed, the San Diego Padres, that's not surprising necessarily. Last year, they were the 4 seed, and I think they would have been 2 if they had not lost some games late in the year. And they would play the St. Louis Cardinals at the 7 seed. Cardinals last year were the 5 seed. Again, not all that different. You're not seeing that strange of a setup. The 3 seed would have been the Dodgers, which is surprising perhaps because the Dodgers were the 1 seed last year in the NL. They would play the Cubs. Again, the Cubs made the playoffs as the 3 seed, so it would have been flipped. They instead of being the 3 seed, they would play the 3 seed. And then finally, we would have the number 4 seeded New York Mets against the number 5 seeded Milwaukee Brewers. So the Mets would be the only team that are kind of the weird team in there that didn't make the playoffs last year that then ascended to a top 4 seed and home field advantage in the first round this year. And otherwise, it doesn't seem that strange. I would like to see, you know, how the Giants would do as the 1 seed and you know, the Dodgers playing the Padres potentially in the second round if things go chalky there. And then maybe Dodgers Giants for the NLCS. These would have all been great matchups.
That's a bad draw for the Cubs. I mean, you can't be happy with that.
No, but they had a chance last year, though, as the 3 seed, and they drew the Marlins, which is the easiest possible seed by the records. Fair. And they ended up losing.
Yep. Baseball. True. It's random.
Yeah. Which, you know, I think we can quibble about the lengths of some of those series from last year. But the matchups in the NL seem fine. Now, over in the AL, let's go through those. So the 1 seed would be the Red Sox. They did not make the playoffs last year, and they would ascend to the number 1 overall seed in the league. That would be interesting and different. And guess who they would play in the first round? The 8 seeded New York Yankees. So you're 1 versus 8 in the first round immediately. Red Sox Yankees. I'm here for that. Certainly, I think all of our various broadcast friends would definitely be here for that as a series in the first round. The 2 seed would be the White Sox, which last year the White Sox slipped to the 7 seed. So this time they would be on the other end of it. But again, that was a situation where I think they were in position for a higher seed until the very end of the season, which of course was like a large percentage of the season, just a couple weeks represented last year. So they as the 2 seed would be playing the 7 seed Blue Jays, which are a really entertaining up-and-coming team, and that would be a great series. I mean, I would love that series. The Rays would be the 3 seed if we froze things at 60 games. They'd play the 6-seeded Indians, who I think are actually would have been lucky that if the season ended at 60 games because they're sort of trending in the wrong direction. But Rays Indians as your 3 versus 6, and then Athletics versus Astros as your 4-5, which of course would be a rematch of a second-round series from last year. So again, not that different, very similar group of teams from last year, with some exceptions. I think the Red Sox would replace the Twins, in that group of teams and then slide up to the 1 seed. But otherwise, it would be very similar. And I think that's really interesting that if we, we froze the season this year at 60 games and looked at the playoff teams and then compared that to what was necessarily frozen after 60 games, because that's all there were last year, you get mostly the same teams as you did a year ago. And, a lot of really interesting matchups. So I'm not advocating that MLB stop the season now and have a shorter season. Again, I enjoy the 162. I think some of these will definitely, the playoff teams will change, not just because of the larger number, but there are some cases where teams in our model, at least, think that, you know, maybe they played above their head and with a larger sample, they might regress. Like the Red Sox, you know, are projected to finish as a wild card, not as a division winner, certainly not as the number 1 overall seed in the AL. And, you know, there's other cases where teams maybe got off on the wrong foot, but have more talent. Maybe the Yankees are an example of that, and they're expected to progress toward the mean. So things are probably going to be different by the end of the season, but I just am fascinated by the fact that you can kind of compare last year's weird shortened season and then a hypothetical weird shortened season this year playoff picture and get pretty similar teams. And I think what would be some pretty entertaining matchups, almost like what if there was an argument for MLB sort of like taking the season and splitting it into multiple little pods of the season, like split seasons, and then having a little playoff inside of those, and then having the winner of those playoffs play in like this meta playoff at the end of the year. That's kind of similar to what they did in 1981 in terms of having the split season. But just something to think about for Rob Manfred.
Can we call it the meta playoff?
The meta playoff. The MLB meta playoff.
You know, it's interesting that there's a part of me that just wishes the season was over because it's been so disappointing. But, you know, even
for
though
the
there's
twins, to
yes,
clarify.
For me personally, it has been very disappointing. But there's an interesting thing where, you know, for the twin season basically is over. I mean, they're at the moment, so past the 60 games that you were doing that thought experiment on. But at the moment, they're 15 games out of first in the Central. Like they're, you know, they're 14 games below 500.
They have a 2% playoff chance.
Sure. And of course, mathematically, there's certainly a chance for them to fix their pitching and get back into it. They certainly could, but they won't, right? Like at this point in a season, now teams switch to selling players off, and then the teams that are in it will, you know, look to strengthen things. And so there is sort of this point at a season when a team stops trying to make up the ground that they've lost. And maybe 60 games is where we think like, all right, well, this season is lost. I mean, the trade deadline is still a little ways away, and yet there will start to be trades made probably. I'm assuming that the Twins and some of the other underperforming teams are going to start selling off some players.
I was trying to think of like who of all the teams Neil mentioned and the teams, actually, more importantly, the teams he didn't mention, who among the teams he didn't mention do you think will end up being a playoff team is what I guess I'm curious
about. Yeah, probably Atlanta.
Probably Atlanta is might be the only one, right?
Yeah, I mean, so the rest of the teams in that division that aren't the Mets, like the Nationals, they seem like they're just sort of, you know, they're this close to selling. I think the Max Scherzer thing last week even may have like tipped the scales toward that as much as anything. And the Phillies are just drifting aimlessly. So, you know, there's
yeah,
a lot of teams.
The Phillies might be the other team I would put in that bucket.
Yeah, they may have a run left in them, maybe.
They're only four games back of the Mets. I mean, that's
not
insurmountable.
I know. I still think Atlanta is probably the bigger threat to the Mets, but I wouldn't count off it. That would be probably my second choice. And in the AL, I'm not even sure who would. I mean, I don't expect anything of the Angels at this point.
No.
Minnesota, Sarah,
the less said about
apologies.
Them, the better. Yeah, they're terrible.
The less said about them, the better. And unless they were to go, I will say that I do think the AL Central is a trash can, and they have a lot of games against the Tigers, Royals, and I don't think the Indians are very good. And the Indians, so I mean, if they were to win,
no, they're gonna start selling.
See, look, this is once again me being optimistic for Sarah. This happens with the Vikings normally, but
I mean,
if
you're
they were to win 10 of the next 12,
they'd still be below 500 if they won 10 of the next 12.
You might not be like, oh, they should become sellers at that point. So, but I generally do think the 60 games is a pretty good bellwether in terms of who's good, because just looking at I don't really think there's any team in the AL that you didn't mention that I think will inevitably be in the playoffs.
Yeah, it really is interesting to see how that works and to look at these teams and think, yeah, that makes sense.
Really seems right. Like aside from the Red Sox at the one seed, I don't think anybody really saw that
and
coming.
The Giants.
Or the Giants,
I mean,
at the one seed.
As much as we love the Giants, it seems legit. It's not like they're one of these teams with these like really funky run differentials. You know, they're plus 72.
Well, in this alternate universe, I'm looking forward to the chalk one seed Red Sox versus one seed Giants in the World Series.
There we go. That's the World Series we need. Let's just call it off now. We're done. In fact,
yeah,
the last couple
in
of
about
games.
A month.
Yeah. Let's just call it. All right. Well, thank you for that, Neil. That was a very fun look into where comparing last year to this year in baseball. That will do it for this week's show. We'll be back in your feed next Tuesday. If you like what you heard, please subscribe. And if you are subscribed, please rate and review us on your podcast app of choice. It helps new people discover the show. You can also email us at podcast@538.com to let us know what you think. Our podcast producer is Sarah Shackett. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. And our podcast commissioner is Chad Matlin. For Neil and Jeff, I'm Sarah. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.